KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. There's really no two ways around it. The recently released trailer for the upcoming movie Suicide Squad is pretty dark. It features a group of supervillains, serial killers, among other really awful people, who are forced to engage in acts of heroism under the threat of having bombs set off in their heads. Our society has a complicated history with its villains, and it's only getting more so. We used to fear them, now sometimes we revere them, and increasingly we're creating them. Today we'll be joined by author Chuck Klosterman and movie producer Michael Uslan. They're going to help us unwrap why it is that it used to be easier to tell the good guys from the bad guys. For one thing, they used to wear different colored hats. Villains, after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about villains, and if that sounds like a dark subject, well, it is. But it's also a relevant one, because it's getting harder in popular culture to tell the good guys from the bad, and because we seem to be growing more likely to make villains of other people. Helping us sort through this today will be Chuck Klosterman. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, I Wear the Black Hat, which is a funny and self-reflective collection of essays about villains, both fictional and real. He's joining us from a studio in New York today. Chuck Klosterman, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Also joining us a little later today will be Michael Uslan, who's a producer of every Batman movie since 1989, which means he's helped bring a lot of villains into our movie theaters and our homes over the years and helped guide the evolution of characters like the Joker. His autobiography is called The Boy Who Loved Batman, and he co-teaches an online course about the rise of superheroes and their impact on pop culture that begins next month. More on that in just a little bit. We invite you, our listeners, to join us with a comment or a question. Have you ever rooted for a bad guy? Are your heroes outlaws? Or perhaps you pine for the days when the good guys were good guys and the bad guys were bad guys? Talk to us. Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. You can also reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter. Chuck Klosterman, there's something about villains, right? Like created in just the right way that makes them compelling, even alluring. Here I'm thinking about Tony Soprano, Walter White. These are bad people, but people genuinely love these characters. They even relate to them. What's going on there, do you think?
Well, very often when you see an actor, for example, doing interviews about a film they're going to be in, say a James Bond movie, and they're playing the villain, and they, of course, are asked, you know, why did you select this character? Why did you want to be this villainous person? And their natural reaction, usually the gut reaction, is for them to go, oh, well, you know, it was just such an interesting character. It was more interesting than the hero. But I suspect this is, to a degree, coded language, and that when they use the word interesting, what they're really saying is realistic. Because I think that as society has evolved and as people sort of have changed the way they perceive themselves and what human nature is, the idea of a purely heroic character or a fundamentally good person seems almost like an implausible fantasy. Whereas even a good person is aware of what they are theoretically capable of, what bad things they could do if they allowed themselves to sort of slide in that direction. So I think when they see someone like Walter White, they don't think to themselves, that guy's exactly like me, but they do think to themselves, I could imagine myself in that position doing things like that. And it's almost as if the nature of culture has moved humanity toward an acceptance of problematic figures.
What do you think has changed in our society? This kind of created that space, that change that now we can imagine ourselves like Tony Soprano, like Walter White. I mean, maybe we could always do that, but but we're free to do it now? Or what do you think?
You know, in a lot of ways, it may just be opportunity. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a long tradition in literature of antiheroes. You could read a novel about a problematic protagonist, you know, in 19th century or whatever. And then in film, it didn't really happen until the 1970s when the auteur movement happened. You saw the Godfather films. You saw that period of films where Jack Nicholson was especially interesting, even though he wasn't necessarily a good guy. And film kind of embraced the idea of a villainous hero. And then in the 80s and 90s, you saw this kind of happen in music with first sort of glam metal, but then also in hip hop with groups like NWA, where villainy was part of their iconography. And then finally it happened in television, really starting with The Sopranos in the late 90s. And now, if you're making a sophisticated television show, you're almost obligated to have sort of a negative character be at the center of the story. So in some ways, it may have been that this urge was always there, but there was no way to access it through popular culture for a very long time. Now, since it's everywhere, people can like full on embrace it and actually say it's what they prefer about narrative storytelling.
You write in your book as well about villainy in sports. I'm a Bay Area native, so I was instantly interested in your conversation about the Oakland Raiders under Al Davis and how they kind of took on this villainous role, and people loved them for it, or they hated them for it, but either way, they were selling tickets.
Well, what was so interesting about the Raiders during Al Davis's tenure there, which is really the totality of the franchise until he died in many ways, you know, sports gives people the opportunity to hate people without justification. If you live in Dallas, you can hate the Philadelphia Eagles. If you live in Philadelphia, you can hate the New York Giants. You don't need a reason. But some teams and some athletes sort of transcend that, the Raiders being the clearest example, where they very consciously wanted people to see them as sort of a nefarious, villainous organization. One, for kind of the intimidation value of it, but also as a way to attract a certain kind of fan and a certain kind of player. I mean, if you look at the Raiders in the 70s and 80s, one of their strengths was consistently signing players other teams had given up on, very often for off the field or sort of social reasons. But the Raiders made it very clear, we will accept that kind of player. And it sort of changed the mentality of the team. In some ways, the Raiders were the most pro-labor NFL football team of all time, because it seemed as if the inmates kind of ran the asylum.
You mentioned that in sports you don't necessarily need a reason to hate. I think for a long time, as a society, we've been working toward teaching people that in most other realms in our society, you really have to have a pretty good reason to hate. And I'm wondering what you think about how, you know, the end of the Cold War plays in this. And we have this space in our history, you know, for quite some time up until 9/11, where there wasn't a obvious big bad enemy. And it was harder just to say, like, that, you know, we have good and evil in the world. And do you think that had an impact on our popular culture and how we conceived of heroes and outlaws, heroes and villains?
Well, that's very interesting. To a certain degree, I think I disagree with what you're arguing. I do agree that the Cold War, particularly end of the Cold War up until probably 9/11, that was really the height of this idea that if you hate something, you have to have a justification for it. You even saw this when the Cold War was still going on. You'd see an episode of Family Ties, for example, and Alex P. Keaton is in a chess match against a high school student from Russia. And of course, they hate each other because it's the 80s, and then they realize, oh, we're all the same people. You know, it's like that these just justifications for having issues with someone were manufactured. I think it's kind of swung back the other way now. I mean, and really as an extension of social media, that now it has sort of become acceptable to villainize or hate someone for one reason, that they disagree with your identity politics or your politics about, you know, the Middle East or very, you know, actually sort of isolated ideas, that alone is a reason to sort of think of a person in a totally different way as a complete entity based on sort of their one idea. So I'm not sure if we're moving in a direction where the reason to see someone as a villain has become more difficult. It's probably become easier.
Hmm. That's Chuck Klosterman, a cultural critic and the author of numerous books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, probably the best-titled book ever. And his latest is the New York Times best-selling book, I Wear the Black Hat. Chuck Klosterman, you write that to be a villain, you have to know the most and care the least. Can you unpack that for us a little?
Well, okay. I think I work maybe a little differently than most people who write essay collections. I think for a lot of writers, they start with a thesis and then they try to write a whole book around that idea. I do the opposite. I basically write about things that are interesting to me and I look for a thesis that sort of connects these disparate ideas. And the closest I came with this book, and it wasn't perfect, but it was close, this idea that a villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. What I kept seeing over and over again, and there are some exceptions, but for the most part, what really bothers the average person about a public figure, fictional or unfictional, is the idea that they have a complete and total understanding of how to manipulate the culture, how to succeed, what people want to hear, what people are afraid of. They really understand human nature, but they do not care what the consequences of their actions reflect. In other words, they have the ability to be good or bad, and they're consciously choosing to be bad. So if someone is doing any act, and as much as it might be damaging to society, if there's some glimmer that they're doing this because they believe this to be the best thing for society, then it gets real complicated. It's when someone seems to almost enjoy the idea that they are apolitical about the world at large. I mean, you're going to talk to the guy who produced those Batman movies. I mean, the Joker was actually a character like this, someone who seemed almost obsessed with their own ability not to care about people's welfare. So I often saw this in the people I wrote about, that when you start stripping away the specifics of the event and you start sort of removing the political context or the social context, it came down to this idea that the person was intelligent and did not care what being intelligent meant.
Has that created the ground for the villainization of the current United States president? I think you write in your book that George W. Bush, his predecessor, lots of people didn't like him, but he didn't kind of rise to that level of villainy. But I'm wondering if you share that assessment about the current president. I'm not asking if you think he's a villain. I'm asking if you think that in a lot of people's eyes, this current president has achieved that status, and if so, if that has something to do with this idea of being the person who knows the most, his intelligence. He's a manipulator. He knows the consequences of actions, but he wants to destroy things.
Well, I guess I would say no. I mean, you're talking about his predecessor, George Bush. The second George Bush, he was rarely seen as a villain. There were people who hated him, but Dick Cheney was seen as much more villainous. He seemed much more manipulative and sort of used his understanding of how politics works and used Bush almost as a way to work through that. Is Obama seen as a villain? Well, I suppose by the kind of person who would always think a president from an opposing party is a villain, maybe to some political historians who say ultimately the main takeaway from his administration will be expanding the powers of the presidency, maybe they will see that as villainous. But, he's a pragmatist. I mean, Obama is a pragmatist. He seems like a very reasonable person. I would be pretty surprised if when his administration is looked back upon in some distant future that there's any memory of villainy in his sort of legacy.
On the subject of President Obama, you noted maybe with just a touch of humor that back in 2012, Barack Obama was asked about The Wire and his favorite character on The Wire. And he chose Omar, this drug dealer and kind of remorseless killer, and you quote or you say, and here I quote, he became the first sitting president to express admiration for a fictional homosexual who killed dozens of people with a shotgun.
That's true, but here's the other key thing about Omar's character. Omar was someone who only robbed other drug dealers. So on a superficial level, yes, it seemed very weird that the president, like if you had said in, say, 1972, that some future president, and in the not too distant future, was going to lionize a gay character, an African-American character on television who sold drugs and killed people, it would seem crazy. But if you actually unpack sort of the structure of how The Wire operated, Omar was the most moral character on the program. So when when Obama says that, one, by noting The Wire, he's noting that the shows he watches have a political center to them. And then within that sort of political portrait, he's most interested in the person whose ethics are the most rigid. The cops and the other drug dealers on The Wire, it seems as though they could go either way, but Omar does not.
Do you think our villains have to have redeeming qualities in them in order to be interesting?
Not necessarily, but typically. I mean, it really depends on who the audience is. If you're dealing with a teenage audience for a film or a television show, you could probably have a one-dimensional villain. I don't know if a sophisticated audience would accept that, because in the same way that a totally good character, a totally good hero, seems implausible, a totally bad character seems easy. Yeah.
That's Chuck Klosterman. His book, I Wear the Black Hat, was a New York Times bestseller. The paperback version promises now with more villainy. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're talking about villains. What is it that draws us to them? Why have we gotten so good at creating them? We'd like you to join the conversation. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. We are joined today from a studio in New York by Chuck Klosterman, the author of I Wear the Black Hat. And also joining us from a studio in New Jersey now is Michael Uslan, a longtime superhero movie producer, writer, and teacher, who's a producer of every Batman movie since 1989. He's also helped guide the evolution of characters like the Joker in popular culture. His autobiography is called The Boy Who Loved Batman. And he co-teaches an online course about the rise of superheroes and their impact on pop culture that begins next month. And you can find more information on that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. He's joining us today from a studio on the campus of Montclair State University in New Jersey. Michael Uslan, thank you for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here participating.
Excellent. I wanted to bring you into this conversation to really kind of take a little bit of a deeper dive on fictional villains. And then I'd like to move our conversation back into villainy in the real world. Back in the 1970s, you started teaching courses in comic books.
Right.
And since then, you've been involved in bringing some of the world's most iconic fictional villain to movie screens. What do you think has changed about villains in those past few decades?
You know, I would love to tell you a lot has changed, but I think if we really examine it a little bit more closely from the 60s and 70s to today, we may find that not a whole lot has really changed. Look, in the 60s, we had a youth movement in this country that came out of a reaction against the Vietnam War. Talk about villains. Richard Nixon was one of the most vilified presidents in history at the time. The police, starting primarily in Chicago 68, the convention, were called pigs, and there was a real super generational reaction against authority. It was a far cry from the days when our politicians were some of our heroes, like JFK. When we had astronauts we all could worship, and today we don't even know their names. When we had sports figures, like for me, Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays, and today we've got steroid-ridden and football-deflating heroes. There's always been a need for heroes, but even going back to the 60s and 70s, we had really the rise of anti-heroes. Look at The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman's role. It was indicative of a sea change of what we deem to be a heroic figure in the movies. The Godfather in the 70s is probably the epitome of that. You could look to Archie Bunker on television as being this sort of anti-hero hero. And even on Broadway, at that time, Frank Langella was doing one of the most romanticized, positive interpretations of Dracula the world had ever seen. If we go back to movies again, we have things like The Magnificent Seven. The Dirty Dozen is maybe the best example. Kelly's Heroes, of groups of villains who come together for a greater cause or to face a greater threat to humanity. And it largely becomes about redemption. So I think in the polarized world we are living in right now, there's actually a lot of similarity between our search for heroes and the kind of heroes we are looking to.
Do you think there's something different about the kinds of villains that we're looking to?
Well, I think the villains today are far more textured. They are far more sophisticated in their presentation. We no longer live in this idealized world of black and white, of good versus evil. We find ourselves today in a very gray world of what I would call order versus chaos. And in this world, it's sometimes hard to separate out in that gray field the heroes from the villains. And one of the things that the genius Christopher Nolan addressed in the Dark Knight trilogy was, in this post-9/11 world we're living in, how far down can a hero sink before he takes on the tactics of the villain, before the hero, in an attempt to stop the villain, becomes, in effect, the villain himself? At what point do you have to say no and not sink to that level? And it really created a situation where a lot of critics, a lot of reviewers, have called those films the best post-9/11 films we've had yet in this country.
That's a theme that seems like it's going to be reflected again in two other DC-based movies, DC comic-based movies, Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman, which you're an executive producer of. How can you take this any further than it already is? I mean, it seems like the line separating our heroes and our villains now is so razor thin as it is. Can we get any more nuanced?
Well, I think so. Again, movies like comic books are a mirror of our society. It's a reflection of us and where we are at today. And I think we are in this, I won't call it a struggle, I'll call it more of a search for heroes. And it's nothing new. Look, the ancient tales of Moses and Hercules, Odysseus, Beowulf, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, which is the basic example, modernized, of the Justice League and the Avengers. These are all rooted in mankind's history, where we have a need to be inspired. We need our heroes. And the ancient heroes fought their demons and their dragons. And our heroes today, while they may be clothed in spandex and capes, they are still fighting the demons and dragons of the world today. So, yes, the line could get kind of blurry, but I think the lines in our society have gotten blurry. And if we look to the history of comic books per se, you can see that going back, all the way back, our supervillains have ranged from, during World War II, blood-dripping, fanged Japanese and the evil Nazis, who were only after World War II truly supplanted in the comics by the supervillain that could take the place of a threat that great. And now, as comic books and graphic storytelling have grown more sophisticated and mature and been reaching out to adult audiences, the characterizations and the stories have become far more complex. And again, that represents an evolution in the world of graphic novels and comic books.
Michael Uslan, I tend to think of the world as this place. It's full of people who are either Batman people or Superman people. I'm curious to know whether you think audiences are going to come into Batman versus Superman having already chosen their hero and their villain, or are we a sophisticated enough society to reserve judgment until the movie's over?
You know, I am going to let every single individual come to their own conclusion about that. Whether you want to enter into this as if it is the World Series or the Super Bowl or the WWE Championship, or you want to look at it at layers well beyond that and themes well beyond that, I leave it to the individual. I think thematically, and again, in comic books, this is a comic book convention that goes all the way back. When two heroes tended to meet for the first time, there was always either a misunderstanding or a villain in the way that had gained control of the mind of one of the heroes. And what that did was created a situation drawn on the cover of these issues of two superheroes battling that always resulted in higher sales. So there is absolutely a marketing move behind that in the history of comic books that has paid off time and time again. I think now we're at a level where it's far beyond that, and it really calls into question some of our basic needs and who we consider and what we as heroes and what we consider to be heroic. And that's going to be tested as these films come out.
That's Michael Uslan. He's a producer for every Batman movie since 1989, including the upcoming Batman versus Superman, which is due out in March. Also joining us today is Chuck Klosterman. His book, I Wear the Black Hat, was a New York Times bestseller. Chuck, let me bring you back into this conversation and bring this conversation, start steering it toward the real-life villains in our world. You start your book with a discussion about Joe Paterno, who is this legendary football coach from Penn State, who is really nothing less than a hero in many people's eyes until almost overnight he wasn't. And this all had to do with his alleged failure to report some really horrendous villainous actions on the part of one of his assistant coaches who is victimizing young boys on the Penn State campus. Overnight, it seems, he went from hero to villain. And it feels like that's something we're seeing a lot these days. In recent months, you could add the actor Bill Cosby to that. In recent weeks, you can add the professional wrestler Hulk Hogan to that, to this list of people who went from hero to villain really quite quickly. Why do you think we're seeing this? How does this happen?
In some respects, we're talking about just the mechanism of social media, because especially in the more recent – the Bill Cosby situation, for example, this is relatively old news. People were talking about this in 1996, but there was no way for the average person to sort of enter in to a collective conversation. Now that we have that possibility, a kind of momentum can create itself there's a thrill from the idea of jumping into sort of the villain vilifying someone because it feels as though you're part of a group now who has a shared goal or whatever. The situation with Joe Paterno was slightly different in the sense that I think initially there was a real strong feeling that, well, he must not have known about this. And then it came out to, well, he did know about it, but, he did the appropriate steps. But in truth, as it kind of unspooled, there was a collective realization that, Joe Paterno was the most powerful man on the Penn State campus. I mean, yes, he had a boss, but he could have got his boss fired at any time during his tenure. So it started to seem as though he acted in a way that he knew was theoretically correct, but realistically completely untrue, that he sort of allowed a situation to happen in fear that it would damage the program if he acted otherwise. And that's kind of what sealed his fate. You know, Sandusky, the man who actually did molest the kids, he's seen like as a flat monster. There's like no one says, well, you know, there's an interesting other side to Sandusky. But with Paterno, it's not like that. He has this huge problem now with his legacy, and people try to balance the rest of his career against that, almost all of which was positive.
Do you think more heroes are going to be facing this challenge in the future, that this need to balance their legacies? You wrote about Muhammad Ali and how largely his legacy has been very absent of the horrible race baiting and racial language that he used. You're talking about Joe Frazier, but that, you know, he's managed to escape that as part of his legacy and is largely just seen as a hero. Does that become more complicated in the new world for most people? For most people who were seen as heroes?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, Muhammad Ali, John Lennon is an example of this. People who had certain aspects of their life, which are really troubling if you take them, you know, separately. But because we look at them historically and we kind of consumed their existence slowly over many years, we kind of balance it on a scale. And we're like, you know, what Muhammad Ali did for the country was so valuable that we're going to take these things that he said about Joe Frazier and all these, you know, that, you know, he once met with the Ku Klux Klan because they both shared the same perspective on interracial marriage. They were both against it. You know, we've kind of removed those things completely and said, on balance, what Ali or John Lennon did was so valuable that we will accept and sort of almost pretend that these negative things did not happen. But now, all these events are taken as single bite-sized sort of examinations of the entire person's character. So if you're a heroic figure in this day and age, or you're somebody who is generally perceived as like a truly upstanding, important person, one detail about your life that people find despicable almost becomes has the same mass as everything else you've done, because we're consuming these things in the present tense in a way we didn't in the past.
Well, and it doesn't just happen to famous people now, right? I mean, today we have the power to villainize people who no one's ever even heard of before. A dentist in Minnesota this week shoots a lion in Africa, and he's instantly villainized. It happens so fast. Nobody's ever heard of this dentist before outside of probably his town in Minnesota, and all of a sudden he's a worldwide scoundrel. Michael Uslan, you've spent a lot of years helping create and craft very textured fictional villains. We live in this world now where we can create real ones overnight, without much texture at all. What do we lose in this new world, do you think?
Well, first of all, I certainly agree that when we're in a world which now has our heroes, or let's at least just call them our protagonists, in a 24/7 spotlight, nobody's perfect. Nobody could maintain that Superman thing morning, noon, and night every single day of the year. There's an electron microscope examining everyone who is taking a public profile in whatever way, shape, or form. And if you then turn to the movies, and let's turn to our superhero movies, you now have more and more heroes that are reflecting things. Well, like the X-Men, they are alienated. They are persecuted. There is an awful large segment of the world population that can relate to what they are going through and cling to them as heroes of hope for the future. You've got the Hulk, who is the ultimate misunderstood monster, misunderstood by society, kind of a modern-day Frankenstein in a sense, who is persecuted out of this misunderstanding, born out of a modernization of the legend of the golem. And even in Batman, again, going back to Chris Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, he's persecuted by Gotham City. And still, even though they persecute him, he rises to the occasion as the hero and is willing to sacrifice his life for that city. And in the Dark Knight trilogy, he talks about the meanings of symbols. And I think that's critically important here, because the concluding chapter of that trilogy was the point that anybody could become Batman. Anybody could make a vow, could be self-sacrificing, could make a commitment and be willing to go through hell for the rest of their life to honor a commitment, to get the bad guys, to do good, becoming urban legends and heroes in the process. And I think that there are huge segments of the population that truly, truly, just like thousands of years ago, hold on to that, are inspired by that, are propelled by that, and it makes it relevant no matter what the age is, no matter what the technology is. There are just certain consistencies that are eternal. And I think this is tapping into all of that.
That's Michael Uslan, who has helped bring us every movie incarnation of Batman and his assorted enemies since 1989. Also joining us today is Chuck Klosterman. His book, I Wear the Black Hat, was a New York Times bestseller. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Matthew LaPlante, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're talking about villains. What is it that draws us to them? Why have we gotten so good at creating them? And we'd like you to join the conversation. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. With us from a studio in New York is Chuck Klosterman, the author of I Wear the Black Hat. Also joining us from a studio in New Jersey is Michael Uslan, a longtime superhero movie producer, writer, and teacher. I have a question via Twitter. Twitter user writes, "We've grown accustomed to seeing moral ambiguity in adult films like Brian De Palma's The Untouchables. What seems surprising today is how many children's films now embrace this. The original villain in Frozen, Elsa, was slightly changed and was made into the hero. And in Big Hero 6, the villain has been seriously wronged and was trying to rescue someone. In another context, he would have been the hero. What's going on here?" Chuck Klosterman, what do you think?
Well, I have sort of a cynical take on this. I have a 18-month-old kid, and I, of course, read his books that are ostensibly designed for him. And yet, I think both in kids' literature and in kids' films, a pretty obvious recognition has been made by the people who produce these that little kids don't have full agency over what they like. The way to make one of these things succeed is to make a product that their parents, who are sort of an ancillary part of this experience, are like, that was really good. I want my kid to like this. I want to share this with my kid. So I think that with all sort of art now directed toward young people, there is often a subtext where how can this connect with the 38-year-old guy or the 29-year-old woman or whoever who is sitting next to this little person as they experience it? I think that children's art is becoming more adult because that's how these things succeed.
Interesting. Michael Uslan, what do you think? Is it important for children to get more textured versions of heroes and villains than perhaps they have in the past? And perhaps then is it okay that they're getting it just by virtue of the fact that it's actually being delivered to their parents?
Well, I think it's of urgent importance that the parents make the decisions in the choice of the material that their children are exposed to or that they share with their kids. And it truly is about sharing. whether you're talking about Batman or Scooby-Doo, if you grew up with this and it was part of your childhood and you embraced it, loved it, when you grow up, you absolutely want to share the experience with your child or your grandchild. For the grandchild or child, it's new and exciting, and for you, it's nostalgic and exciting. So there's certainly something at work with that. Many of the animated films today, kids' films, are written on two levels, so that parents and grandparents who share the experience with their kids cannot necessarily just fall asleep in the theater, but can really enjoy it on a different level. And there are some really, really positive themes and positive images being put out there. Two of my favorites were the movie Up, with the young boy and the grandfather figure, voiced by Ed Asner, The Incredibles. I mean, that was a story of family and the meaning of family. Creatively these days, people are looking for new ways to express creativity. They're looking for new ways to look at old things. So if we're talking about villains, we have to talk about one of the greatest villains in history, and that's the Wicked Witch of the West. Now, today, we have Wicked on Broadway. That is this huge hit, and people love the creativity of it because it does open a door to a whole new way of looking at this villain. And, again, moves the whole thing into a very gray area. So I think in terms of creativity in the industry, it has opened up a door that a lot of writers and creators have been playing with, and that audiences in turn embrace as something new, different, and refreshing.
You're a producer for the Lego Movie. How does President Business fit into all of that?
Well, I think it's the it's the same basic idea, I think, as The Incredibles. It all comes down to the meaning of family, and the ending of the Lego Movie, and I don't mean to give it away to anybody, and the guys...
Oh, everybody has seen it.
All right. Well, the guys who wrote and directed it are absolutely brilliant. I mean, really, really brilliant. And it does something that's not too far different from the old Cat Stevens song when I was growing up, The Cat's in the Cradle. It really makes you pause and think about your life. And I think it's a great lesson for adults, even more so than kids. It's an eye-opener. But anything you can do that can stress family values in that sense in an entertaining way that might resonate with kids and adults is a very good thing to attempt.
My wife and I were watching the original Jurassic Park movie with our daughter the other day, and our daughter, who's 8, said she decided to root for the dinosaurs so that she wouldn't be so upset when the people got eaten. Chuck Klosterman, is that what we're all doing these days? Or, you know, when we kind of link on to these politely nuanced characters, but maybe just, let's just say it, evil characters, are we rooting for the dinosaurs, or are we protecting ourselves from getting hurt? What do you think?
Well, I mean, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, they're sympathetic, I guess. You're not making a terrible point, though. The idea that if you root for a problematic character, you are sort of emotionally protecting yourself because either the character you're rooting for will succeed, or their failure will be mitigated by the realization that, well, you know, for everybody, it's good that guy went down. I'm not so, you know, it's always tough to try to deduce what audiences like about mainstream popular culture. It's often that they don't really know what they want until they see it, and then we have to reverse engineer the explanation.
Well, if I could just jump into this for a second.
Please.
In Jurassic World, when I went to see it, and I enjoyed it a lot, I felt that the first two-thirds of the movie were King Kong and the last third was Godzilla. Now, when I was a kid growing up, this was a long time ago, I was rooting for King Kong. I was rooting for Godzilla over the city of Tokyo when I was a kid. I don't think any of that has changed. I don't really see any generational difference here with this. Whether you're talking about Mighty Joe Young or Gorgo, and I think it's just been true forever. And so I don't see it as a new downside that has suddenly emerged.
What do you guys think? Is there some hope in the fact that we seem as a society to be more ready and willing to root for the villains more often? Maybe there's some hope there that perhaps we're all going to give even the worst among us a chance to be admired and respected and even celebrated, Michael Uslan?
I see this a little bit differently. I see that we live in a polarized country. We live in a polarized world politically, in terms of religion, in terms of cultures. All of a sudden, just in the last few years now, America has been able to export our superheroes, and they have been embraced in a way that has not only transcended borders, but has transcended cultures. And that's incredible. The fact that this pop culture of America, our modern-day folklore and mythology, which is superhero-based, is being so embraced, it is an opportunity for people who are polarized to find some kind of common ground and some kind of positive common ground. And I'm just hoping that in the very near future, it's going to inspire countries in Asia and Europe and South America to give us their heroes, their superheroes, stories and characters who are rooted in their own mythologies, cultures, folklore, history. And that would be a great thing. The Japanese have already gotten a jump ahead with their manga and anime characters. The Koreans are right on their heels with their manhwa graphic novels and materials. And I see it as a great opportunity where maybe it could lead to wider understanding and more common ground among many of us. I think it's a great thing.
Chuck Klosterman, you literally wrote the book on villains. Do you think that our villains can transcend cultures or do transcend cultures the same way that our heroes have been able to in recent years?
Oh, I certainly think there's a potential for that. To answer your previous question, though, it's, you know, the idea of mass society being more willing to sort of embrace and appreciate and maybe feel empathy toward villains does indicate an amplification of self-awareness. That this idea that a one-dimensional character is unreal and the idea that someone is inherently evil isn't really reasonable, that does show sort of a collective increase in self-awareness. Now, the real question is, does an increase in self-awareness make people happier? You know, we all sort of strive to be self-aware, but does consciousness actually make people feel better about their lives? It's an interesting thing. I do think culturally that we're getting a little smarter, and I wonder what the downside that will be on sort of the emotional state of the average person.
You write about this in your book really amusingly, but maybe sort of sadly too, about a Major League Baseball player who you knew as a kid and sort of decided at that time was going to be your archenemy. And no matter what this guy did in his future, forevermore, you always questioned his motives. And you wrote, "I have the ability to think about this person in 1,000 different contexts, yet I prefer keeping my mind unchanged."
Yeah, I went to basketball camp with a kid named Rick Helling, and we were both I was a seventh grader and he was an eighth grader. And at the time, he was just seemingly the worst person I had ever encountered in my entire life. I couldn't believe it. He was such a great basketball player. Perhaps I was envious to a degree of his physical skill, but he just did not act the way I wanted someone to act, you know. And I sort of followed his career through high school. We went to different schools, and you know, as he became a major league player, and you know, I never got over this experience when we were in junior high, and I always questioned everything about him. As it turns out, the main thing history is going to remember Rick Helling for is the fact that he appears to have been the very first Major League Baseball player to openly take a stand against steroid use and PEDs before anyone was.
This guy was a hero.
Yeah, well, that's how it will seem, since most people are remembered by one thing in their life, right? That just is the way history tends to work. That will be his defining thing. So then my defining thing will be the guy I picked to be my arch enemy is a historical hero. So that was it's a strange thing to realize.
And is this, Michael Uslan, do you think this is part of kind of your role in life, is to kind of like jog people out of hard and fast opinions about who is a hero and who is a villain?
No, not at all. Those are choices to be made by the great filmmakers and the people who have a specific vision for a character that they love and understand and have a a way to execute that and bring that vision to life. For me, it all began with coming out of the Batman TV show when I was a kid and seeing that the whole world was laughing at Batman and considered him a joke. That just killed me. And for me, my mission became, I need to show the world the true Batman, the way he was created in 1939 as a creature of the night stalking criminals from the shadows. And that became my life's mission. And what I love to do is to bring comic books to the screen. I love to make sure that the people involved in the comic book industry who have been turning out these great stories for now 75 years in some cases finally get credit where credit is due after so many years of kind of being looked down the nose at. And I think anything that we've been able to do to elevate these characters, bring them to world attention, and bring honor and respect to their creators, the artists, the writers, that to me has been the greatest thing. And today we find original works of comic art and comic books themselves on display from the Louvre to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, galleries, museums. It's a great thing, and that to me was the most important thing setting out.
Very quickly, Chuck Klosterman, black hat or white hat for you? I've got one.
You want me to say what I'm wearing?
No, I want you to say what you want. If you had a choice, you have to put one on today, black hat or white hat?
Oh, I'd always want to be the white hat. You got to aspire to be good, right?
Michael Uslan, black hat or white hat?
I'm going to wear the gray one.
That's Michael Uslan. He's a producer for every Batman movie since 1989, including the upcoming Batman versus Superman, which is due out in March. Also joining us today was Chuck Klosterman. His book, I Wear the Black Hat, was a New York Times bestseller. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction today from Michael Havey. The show is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Matthew LaPlante.